introduce our main speaker, Chuck D. from Santa Ana.
Hi, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Chuck. And I bring you greetings from the People's Republic of Orange County. Bakersfield has a tender significance to me because I attended my first conference in this very room several years ago. And this morning, I have the joy of having my baby daughter and her husband here attending their first AA conference or get-together. As I sat here listening to the people talk this morning and reminiscing about the ones that have talked over the weekend, I knew exactly how Zsa Zsa's new husband felt. I knew what was expected of me. I just didn't know how to make it interesting. I know it wasn't planned this way, but John came and spoke at a place where I was getting treatment many years ago. Angie became a very dear friend in my first year of sobriety and sent me, reluctantly, against my permission, to a meeting in East L.A. to speak for her when her sister passed away. And the Mexican community was all men. They were expecting Angie, and they got this gringo there. And I wasn't sure I'd away from there, and I have the privilege of going back there every year, so I guess it turned out all right. And Paul was one of the physicians that treated me in that place, and I had the privilege to get to know Paul the person and not the doctor, and Paul the member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because my wife and I ran with him and several other couples, and we would go to meetings on Wednesday night, and we would go to Lagoon on Saturday night. And at that time, we had birthdays, and they were something special, especially the 1 years. They were reverend as a baptism. They were as joyful as a bar mitzvah, and probably more boastful than a Irish wake. But they were special, and we had one just about every week or so. And I remember that very well. Also, the parties we had on Saturday night where you made your own banana splits, and Sundays, 20 pounds later, you know how it goes. I'm very grateful to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I woke up one morning, and I had drank too much the night before. And what I decided to do, if I could make it, was go to work that day. And after work, I would get something to eat. And after I had something to eat, I would run and join Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did that, and it's been fantastic ever since. And if you believe that crap, this next hour is going to be a pushover. Since my wife is with me today, I have to welcome the Al-Anons, the member of the Release Corps. And also remind you, if it wasn't for us, there wouldn't be any of you. I would also like to welcome the newcomers that are here this morning. And if you are not sure you're in the right place, let me assure you that I would rather be in this place by mistake than sitting in some bar by mistake. And if you're one of those people that are out there and you're spending money you don't have to buy things you don't need to impress people you don't like, chances are you're alcoholic. And if your thinking is such that if one's good, two's better, and if you can get it on credit, take four, your chances are good of being an alcoholic. And if you're sitting there right this morning and you know that two and two is four, but you don't like it, I know you're alcoholic. And if you will stick around and do the things that are suggested by the people that have gotten here before you, such as read the book, go to meetings, talk to other alcoholics, and lately I've had to add, try not to drink between meetings. And the reason I add that, I was passing a friend of mine at the Monday night stag I attend, and he was talking to one of his newcomers, and he asked him if he ever thought about not drinking. And the newcomer got belligerent, and he said, "I do everything you've told me to do. I read the book, I go to meetings, I talk to other alcoholics, and never once have you ever told me not to drink." So let me say that this program works better if you don't drink. As a matter of fact, this program is not for people that drink, it's for people that don't drink. And if you'll stick around long enough, I can't guarantee you that Alcoholics Anonymous will open the gates of heaven and let you in, but it will open the gates of hell and let you out. I doubt if you have anyone here on a court card. But in Santa Ana, we call that a nudge from the judge. And I always like to tell a true story about how a judge friend of mine got to the fellowship of AA to make you feel just a little more at home. My friend Bob had promised his wife on several occasions that he wouldn't drink again. And on one of those occasions, Bob went 2 whole weeks without taking a drink. And he'd had a bad day in court, and driving home he had an urge to just have one drink. And he stopped, but he woke up about 4 hours later and he had thrown up all over his nice suit. And driving home he had no idea what he was going to tell his wife when he got there. And he walked in the door and she met him with those cold, beady little Al-Anon eyes that we've all had to look at one time or another. And she said, "Bob, for God's sakes, it's only been 2 weeks and you promised me you wouldn't drink again, and look at you, you're a mess and you stink." With his keen mind, he looked her straight in those eyes and he said, "But it's not the way it appears. On the way home tonight, it was pouring down rain, it was cold and wet, and I saw this young man hitchhiking and I felt sorry for him and I gave him a ride, but I didn't know he was drunk. And he got in the car and he got sick and he threw up all over me. But I took care of him. I carried him down to the jail and I had him locked up, and I'll see him first thing in the morning." Well, she bought that story. And the next morning, Bob's sitting in his chambers and the phone rang and it was his wife, and she said, "Bob, have you seen that young man that threw up all over you last night?" And he thought real quick and he said, "No, dear, but he's the first one on the docket. And I've already decided that I'm going to give him 30 days. She said, "Bob, I think you better give him 90 days because he's shitting your pants, too." Bob... Bob celebrated 22 years in our fellowship last January. So it's not how you get here that matters, it's what you do after you get here that makes the difference. I have heard this meeting referred to by several people as a spiritual meeting. And you know, I've never been to an AA meeting at all that I didn't think was not spiritual, no matter when it is. This morning, I'm supposed to share with you what it used to be like, what happened, and why it hasn't changed a hell of a lot. I was born sober into a Southern Baptist family, and my grandmother raised me until I was about 12 years old, and I was taken in by a Jewish Orthodox family, and they sent me to a Catholic military school. Until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had prayed to whom it may concern all my life. But that's not the reason I became an alcoholic. I became an alcoholic because I started drinking. And I never want to forget the very first drink I had. I'd already finished school, and I was home on leave from the Air Force, and I'd gone to a theater, and afterwards I stopped at a private club my family belonged to, and it was rather late, and they were closing. And I walked right in, and I sat down at the bar, and I ordered a bottle of beer. And the bartender had known me all my life, and he asked me if I had started drinking since I left home. And I said, "No, John, I've never had a drink in my life, but tonight I'm just going to have one bottle of beer." And he gave me a Miller's High Life, and I picked it up, and I drank it as fast as I possibly could, because I was afraid that somebody might walk in that club and see me drinking that bottle of beer. Now, the reason I have to remember that so vividly today, and actually, if I'd have known then what I knew now, I wouldn't have drank it so fast, because somewhere between that first swallow and that last swallow, I did something called social drinking. But the reason I have to remember that so vividly for me today, sitting at that bar that evening, I had no marital problems. I wasn't even married. I had no job problems because I was doing exactly what I had wanted to do ever since I was a teenager and had gone to one of the best military schools in the country to get ready for it. And I had no financial problems. And sitting there that evening for no reason whatsoever, I blew almost 22 years of total sobriety. And I know standing here this morning, I could do that same thing all over again. Because it's not when everything is coming down on me that I have the fear of drinking again. It's when everything seems to be going okay. It's when the wife is okay and the kids are okay and the job is okay. I get that stinking thinking that just maybe that last drunk wasn't quite that bad. So I have to go to a lot of meetings on a daily basis so I can see what happens to people that don't go to meetings. And it's been my experience that most of those people will go back out and drink again. So I have started looking at the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous like my big fort. And those people that go outside the fort and drink again are my scouts. And those scouts come back in the fort with an ass full of arrows saying, "Those Indians are still out there." And I have come to learn that it's a lot easier to stay here than to have to come back. I have also found out that I have to stay close to this program because I know that you will always want me, but I have to always want you. Now, I don't know when I took the next drink. It wasn't that night, but I'm sure it was the next day or two. And when I did, I started a daily drinking pattern which lasted the better part of 15 years of my life, and right up to what I call for me the beginning of my life, or possibly my death march into Alcoholics Anonymous. I locked my office door on December the 22nd to go home for the Christmas and New Year holidays, and the next conscious thing I remember, I was driving to my office, and my wife was in the car with me, and it was January the 5th. And we were approaching a red light not far from our house, and she noticed that my leg was shaking so bad that I couldn't get my foot off the gas to put the brake on. And she asked me if there was anything wrong, and I said, "Nothing that I can't take care of." And I took her to her office that morning, and at that time, her office was about 6 blocks down the same street that mine was located at. But that morning, I turned around and I went back to our house about 10 minutes away.
And I walked in the house and I took down a bottle of vodka and I sat on the counter. And I had to make one of the biggest decisions that I had ever made in my life up until that point. Because I had never taken a drink on a work morning in my life. And I stood there and I stared at that bottle of vodka. And I was also looking at a smaller bottle next to it that was filled with Valium. I had a doctor at that time that thought alcoholism was caused by a Valium deficiency. I still have the same doctor, but his thinking's a lot different. And I didn't want to get hooked on those funny little pills. So I took the drink. And thank God that first drink stayed down. Because there had been a lot of Saturday and Sunday and holidays that first drink in the morning did not stay down. My leg quit shaking, my stomach felt better, and my head seemed to clear up. And I got in my car and I drove to my office. And I went upstairs and I told my staff what a fantastic holiday I had. And I hoped that they had one just as good. And I couldn't remember 15 minutes from the time I locked that office door on December the 22nd till that morning. Everything seemed fine till about 10 o'clock and my secretary brought in some documents that needed my signature. And as she stood there waiting for me to sign them, she noticed that my hand was shaking so badly that there was no way I could sign those papers in such a manner that she would allow them to leave the office. And after a few moments, I told her just to leave them there and I'd do them later. And when she left, I left. And I went back to my house and I had a couple of drinks. And I drove back to the office and I signed those papers without any problem whatsoever. I went to lunch that day and I had my normal lunch. I had a couple of drinks and I ate lunch and I went back to work. But it wasn't but a few days later, still going home every morning after I dropped my wife off, I found myself going to lunch just a little bit earlier. And having just a few more drinks. And pretty soon I would say the hell with lunch. And I would go back to work. And then a few days later, I found myself going to lunch a lot earlier. Having a lot of drinks. And pretty soon I would say the hell with lunch. And the hell with going back to work. And it hit me just that fast. And I did that kind of drinking all the way through the month of January. And on February the 1st, I walked in my office about 7 o'clock in the morning and the phone was ringing. And I was the only one there and I picked it up. And it was my boss on the other end calling me from Dearborn, Michigan. And he proceeded to tell me that I had a drinking problem. And I had 30 days to do something about it. And if I didn't, it could be grounds for termination. And I told that man in no uncertain terms that nobody that far away that only saw me once or twice a year could call me on the telephone and tell me I had a drinking problem and threaten to fire me over it. And I hung up on him. By that time, my secretary had come in and I told her I'd be back in a few minutes. And by then she knew that could be anything from a half hour to a half a day. And as I went down to get in my car, it was ironic, but an acquaintance of mine at the Santa Ana Elks Club had saw fit to let me know that he was buying a cocktail lounge not far from my office that normally opened about 10 o'clock in the morning. But he was going to start opening about 6 or 6:30 a.m., should I ever have a need to come by. And that's exactly where I was headed, down to see Harry. And as I was driving down to Harry's place, it suddenly occurred to me that my very best friend, alcohol, had just turned on me. The very thing that had helped me put up with that woman, raise those kids, work in that corporate structure, and put up with them. And if you don't know who them are, you may not be alcoholic. Because we know who them are. The thing that had helped me do all of that had just turned on me and I couldn't handle it. I had the same feelings a blind man had when a seeing eye dog walked him into a telephone pole. He reached in his pocket and he pulled out a cookie and handed it to the dog. And a man next to him said, "I don't understand you, mister. That dog just walked you into that telephone pole and you're rewarding him with a cookie." He said, "No, you don't understand. I have to give him the cookie to see where his head is so I can kick him in the ass." That's what alcohol had done to me for 15 years. It had fed me and fed me and fed me, and right when I needed it the worst, it kicked me in the rear end. I got to Harry's place, and I went in and I sat down, and he gave me a drink. And I told Harry what my boss had called and said to me that morning. Now, Harry's version of my importance to that company and my pressures and my responsibilities was so much better than my boss's version, I just sat and listened to Harry all day. I didn't have to go back to that office and put up with that crap, but I had to go back the next morning, and I knew the heat was on. And I knew they would start calling and checking on me, and I had to alter my daily routine. And the first thing I had to do was the hardest thing. And that was to cut my lunch hours from 4 hours down to 2 hours. But we do what we have to when the heat's on. I did that kind of controlled drinking all the way through the month of February. March came and nothing happened. I didn't get fired. I didn't even get any threatening phone calls. And in my sick mind, I got the idea that if you worked for a company as big as I did, and if you held a position such as I did, they wouldn't dare fire you over alcohol unless you admitted to somebody you had a drinking problem. So all I had to do was just make sure I never admitted to anyone that drinking was a problem in my life. And I loosened up into the month of March. About 2 weeks into March, I came back from lunch one day, and the phone buzzed, and I picked it up, and it was a dear friend of mine who has since retired from our company, and his office was down the hall from me. And he ran a different division than I did, but we chatted back and forth. And he asked me if I would step down. He'd like to talk to me a minute. And I went down to Ray's office, and he looked at me, and he said, "Chuck, I just came back from Dearborn, and they're talking about you. And if you don't do something about your drinking and do it fast, they're going to fire you. They don't care how fast you progressed, and they don't care how much you've done for the company, and they don't care how much potential you may have left. They can't afford to have you around anymore." I looked at my friend and I told him in no uncertain terms to mind his own damn business. And if he was concerned about people with drinking problems, he had enough of them in his own division. And he probably wouldn't even have to leave his own office to find one. And I walked out and I slammed his door. When I got home that night, something strange happened, because I told my wife what Ray said to me that afternoon. But I did not see fit to tell her that my own boss had called me 6 weeks before and gave me a 30-day ultimatum to do something about a drinking problem. She looked up at me that night with the saddest eyes that I had ever seen on her face up until that evening. And she said, "But you don't drink that much." Now, standing there looking at me, she may not have known that I went back home every morning to drink after I dropped her at her office. And she may not have known that I took anywhere from 2 to 4 hours every day. And I would go to the club and I would sit there and drink my lunch. And she may not have known, standing there looking at me, that I didn't work until 7 o'clock every night. But I would leave my office about 3:30 or 4 o'clock and I would go to one of my favorite 2 watering holes. And I would sit there and drink until 7. And when I got home and I passed out in my chair, it wasn't from a hard day at the office. But looking up at me that night, she knew that she had was going through my second 502 with me. And I had gotten the last one about 10 months prior. And I was on my way to Santa Ana High School to see my son run in a CIF track meet. And on the way to that school, I totally passed out behind the wheel of my car. And I ran a main boulevard stop in downtown Santa Ana. And when the police came and they handcuffed me and they hauled me to jail, they found that I had a 0.36 blood alcohol content at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And she knew that. She also knew that when I got out of jail that night, I called my insurance broker. And I told him that I had run a boulevard stop that afternoon, and I had hit a tree, and I had wrecked my car rather badly. And my friend came by my office the next day, and he told me that I had not hit a tree, I had hit a woman. And my wife knew that. She also knew that that previous Christmas that I was in a total blackout. We were at the Santa Ana Elks Club to have Christmas dinner, and just as they sat the food on the table, I yanked her right out of her chair and I said, "We're not having Christmas dinner with all these phonies." And there was a prominent attorney across the table, and I looked at him and I said, "You're the biggest phony in this room. If a person doesn't have money, property, or prestige, you won't represent them." And I looked at his wife and I said, "I don't know how. You have been married to this fat pig for over 25 years. I will not sit and eat with him." And I drugged my wife out of that club. She also knew standing there that that same club would have to call her three or four nights a week to come and take her drunken husband home because he was too drunk to get from the bar stool out to the parking lot. And those nights I could get to the parking lot and drive home, she would have to come out in the driveway and help me in the house so that our children would not see their father so drunk that he couldn't even walk from the driveway into the house without falling down. But more vivid in her mind that night that she shared with me months later were the nights that were becoming more frequent in our house. The kind of nights that maybe only the spouse of an alcoholic would really understand. And that's those nights that were becoming just too quiet. And she would come looking for me. And she would find me sitting in my chair with a shotgun to my stomach or a pistol in my mouth, fully loaded, with a hammer pulled back and my finger on the trigger, mumbling some kind of a prayer that I might be able to fire that gun so that I wouldn't have to go back out there and face life on life's terms one more day. I can tell you this morning, I am so grateful I never pulled that trigger because I would have killed the wrong person. I am not the same person standing here today that was sitting in that chair with that gun in his mouth. And after going to a lot of meetings over the years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have found out that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. That night, my wife said the only thing she could possibly say. Because if she had have admitted she knew I drank that much, she would have also been admitting that she was as sick, if not sicker than I was, for staying there all of those years watching me kill myself one day at a time. After I'd been sober a while, she asked me what I thought an alcoholic was. I told her there were a lot of definitions. One was a person that drinks between drunks, and I sure did that. I know today that a definition of an alcoholic is a person that separates their values from their actions while drinking. But back then I told her that I had made up my own definition for an alcoholic of my type. An alcoholic of my type is a person that drinks to solve problems that are caused by drinking. She said, "In that case, you've been alcoholic for about 4 years, because it was that long that I had been sitting in bars drinking, trying to solve problems that were caused because I was sitting in bars drinking. She said exactly what I knew she would say. And I took her and I put her in the car and we went over to Ray's house and we walked in, unannounced, uninvited, and he told me the next morning at my office, very much unwanted. And I said, "Ray, this is my wife and we've been married a long time. And she knows me better than anyone and she just told me I don't drink that much. And she should know. Now get off my back and leave me alone." The next morning when I dropped her at her office, I knew she knew, even if she wouldn't admit she knew. And I couldn't go back home and drink anymore because she bought the booze for the house. And I knew that she would start watching it. And that morning on the way to my office, I did another first in my life. I stopped at a liquor store. And I knew the owner of that store, but I had no idea that he would be there that early in the morning. And I walked in and there he was behind the counter. And there was no way I was going to leave that store without a bottle. And I told him that I had a friend in the hospital that asked me to bring him a bottle of vodka, but I didn't know what brand he drank. And he took one off the shelf and he set it on the counter and he looked me straight in the face. And he said, "Chuck, I think this will suit your friend fine." And to make it look good, I bought a couple of cups and some ice and some orange juice. And I put it all in a big brown bag and I got in my car and drove to my office. And I sat there and I drank it. A couple of mornings later, I'm back in my friend's store and he's there again. But that morning, I bought a bigger bottle of vodka. And as my friend was ringing up my change, I took the cap off and I threw it in the trash. And I turned that bottle right up to my mouth. And after I got my change, I got in my car and I drove down Tustin Avenue, the main street connecting Santa Ana and Tustin, where my office was located at the time. And I was passing people that I did business with on a daily basis, and I could care less if they saw me with that bottle up to my mouth. I wasn't drinking it anymore because it tasted good. And I wasn't drinking it anymore because I liked it. And I wasn't even drinking it anymore because I wanted it. I was drinking it because I had to have it to get from over here to over there. And it was only 14 blocks. And even though I was running a multi-million dollar business, my biggest decision that I had to make on a daily basis was early in the morning, sitting in that parking lot, when I had to decide if I should drink all that bottle then or if I should save some in case something happened that I couldn't get away to get some more. One morning, I found myself holding that bottle with everything I had in me, praying to a God that I didn't even understand to just let me die in that car. To just let somebody that worked for me come to work and find me dead so that I wouldn't have to go up those stairs and face the humiliation that I had come to know over the last several weeks. It had become a daily routine that every time my boss would call me or somebody needed a big decision made, I would get nervous and I would start gagging and throwing up. And sometimes I would make it out to the men's room, sometimes I would make it to the lobby, and sometimes I wouldn't even make it out of my own office. Ironically, I started drinking because I thought it was heavenly, and I found hell. I drank because I thought it would make me free, and I became a slave to alcohol. And there at the end, I was drinking in order to cope. And here I was sitting in a parked car asking God to let me die. He didn't see fit that I should die in that car. He saw fit that I should go on up those stairs just a few more days. And I came back from lunch one day and the phone was ringing longer than I thought it should and I picked it up. And my secretary was down the hall And it was my boss's secretary asking for him. And I said, young lady, his office is in Michigan and you've reached California. She said, I know, I'm his secretary, and if he's not there, he will be any minute. And I need to talk to him. And I hung up that phone, and I knew good and well he was not flying out to California to promote me. And I had no place I could go, so I just sat there. And he walked in the door, and I told him the secretary was looking for him, and he said that could wait. And Ray was out of town again, and we walked down to Ray's office for privacy. And as we walked in, I sat down. And as my boss was closing the door, he said, Chuck, why didn't you do something about your problem? And I said, what problem? And he got angry and he says, your damn drinking problem, man, you're drunk now, I can smell it. And I knew that that man had flown all the way out here to try to bluff me one more time. Because all I ever drank in the daytime was vodka, and you know you can't smell vodka. He sat down at the desk across from me, and his voice mellowed, and he looked at me. And he said, why? Why did you make it necessary for me to come all this way to fire you? I waited through the month of February and nothing happened. I waited into March and I saw Ray at the home office and I knew how much you admired and respected him. And I asked him if he would talk to you when he got back to California and he said he would. And he did. And I waited, and nothing happened. And I've waited into April, and I just can't wait any longer. And he opened his briefcase, and he took out some documents and laid them on the desk between us. And he said, these are your termination papers, and this is your stock in the company. But I want you to know that all you have to do right this minute is tell me you want help. And I have the authority to put these papers back in my briefcase and take you anywhere as you want to go to get it. If you're new today and you don't understand the insanity that we refer to in our alcoholism, I'll share mine with you. Sitting at that desk that afternoon looking at those papers, I knew that everything I had ever worked for in my life was on the line. I knew it would only be a matter of weeks that my family would leave me. I knew it would only be a matter of weeks that I would be in total financial bankruptcy. And in my career field, that would be job suicide. And knowing all of those things, before I would admit to that man that I had a drinking problem, I pulled those papers in front of me and I signed away everything I'd ever worked for in my life. Looking somewhat shocked, he put the papers in his briefcase, and he said he was going to do two things for me that were not with company policy. The first thing he was going to do was leave my insurance in force for 1 year. And secondly, instead of me cleaning my office out immediately, he would meet me back there at 6 o'clock the next morning so I could do so in private and not have to in front of all the people that had worked for me for all of those years. My wife shared with me later that I must have met him that morning because she came home from her office that afternoon and found my car in the driveway with all my personal effects from the office. And she came running in the house and she found me passed out in my chair. And she was grateful to even find me in that condition and not locked up or dead. Because at that time, one more lockup would have been an automatic 6 months in the Orange County jail. And she knew her husband could not spend 6 months in any jail, let alone the Orange County jail. That afternoon about 6:30, I had my first moment of clarity. I came to and I was as coherent as I could possibly be with as much alcohol as I had in my system. And I was trying to decide if I really wanted to go to lodge that night because I rarely missed if I were in town. And as I was pondering over that decision, my son, who was almost 18 at the time, came out of his room. And in those days, that was unusual enough. But he walked right up to my chair and he stood there and he stared down at me. And as I was finally able to look up at him, he said to me that night, he said, "Dad, you've lost your job. And next to your family, it probably meant more to you than anything in this world. What are you going to lose next?" And without saying another word, he turned and he went back into his room. All of a sudden, I realized that I was a nobody and I was going nowhere. I don't know if I hit my bottom that night in that beautiful home with that lovely family. And up until 24 hours before, I had a job that was the envy of a lot of people. But I saw my bottom, and that was close enough for me. I called my wife into the room and I asked her if there was anything left in the house to drink, and she asked me why. I said, "Because there's a man at the Elks named Jim, and he's in his 60s, and he told me a couple of months ago that he had been drinking ever since he was a small kid. And he had gone to a hospital over in Orange called Beverly Manor. To drink for almost 6 months, and if they could do that for that man at that hospital, they must have a miracle. And I need help, but I also need a miracle, and I want to go there." She said, "Thank God." And she left the room and she came back in a few minutes and she had one of those plastic iced tea glasses about that high and about that big around. And in it she had bourbon and scotch and vodka and wine. Everything she could find. And I took one big swallow. And I said, "What are you trying to do? Kill me?" She smiled and she said, "No. I just don't want anything left in the house to drink when you come home from that hospital. I have a lot of things to be grateful for today, but if somebody were to ask me the one thing that I am the most grateful for, other than the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it would be for that drink. Because if she had to talk me out of that drink, or if she had to refuse to give me that drink, she may have been interrupting my last drunk, and I may have found it necessary over these years to go back out and finish it. And I might not have been as lucky as some of you people in this room today that have been here before, and you have gone back out and been able to get back here again. And if you're new today and you've been around just long enough that you may have heard some jackass at a podium or sitting in some meeting make the statement that the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous are either revolving or swinging, don't you believe it, because it's a damn lie. I have a couple of friends and several acquaintances that have been here before and they're out there now. And they would give anything they have left or anything they may ever get in life to be able to come back in these rooms, and they just can't make it. When I read my big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it tells me that if I continued to drink, two things could happen to me. One, I could go insane, or two, I could die. But I know there's a third thing that can happen to an alcoholic of my type that we don't talk about too much in these rooms. And that's for an alcoholic of my type to be able to go back out into those upholstered sewers. And to be able to sit there for a long time with a head full of AA and a belly full of booze, knowing that this program would work for me too one day at a time, but my pride and my ego would not allow me to come back in these rooms. For me, that has got to be the most god-awful existence for an alcoholic of my type that I can imagine. But because of that drink that night, up until this morning, I have not yet found it necessary to go back out and finish anything. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful. Within an hour, she and my son had me at that hospital. And as my wife was signing me in, my son took me into a room called Detox. And in that room, I had my second moment of clarity. I had never seen the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And that night, I took the first step as honest and as complete and as thorough as any human being could ever be asked to take it. When my son got me undressed and put me in bed, when my head hit that pillow, I said, "Thank God, it's all over. Thank God, I don't have to get up in the morning and go out there and lie and cheat and do all the things I've had to do because of alcohol." And I passed out, and I was out about a week and a half. And when I woke up, I was strapped in that bed from the tip of my toes to the top of my head. Because it seems that there at the end, I was taking Valium by the handfuls, trying to curb the drinking. And when I opened my eyes, I was facing a doorway. And that doorway led into a hall. And the first thing I saw go past my door was a rabbit about 5'2", hopping. And I let out a god-awful scream. And Annie the nurse came running into my room, and I told her what I had just seen, and she started laughing. And she said, "But Chuck, it's Easter." I find that humorous myself this morning. But let me assure you, when I woke up in that hospital, strapped in that bed as I was, and I had a nurse tell me it was Easter Sunday, And the last conscious thing I remembered laying there was locking my office door to go home for Christmas. It scared the living hell out of me, and I hope I never forget that feeling as long as I live. Most of the things I've shared thus far have been told to me after I got here. I stayed in that hospital a long time, and a lot of things happened to me there that saved my life. But time only allows me to touch on just a couple. There was an old counselor there, and I say old with the utmost reverence. He retired last year, and he's my number two sponsor today, and he celebrated 40 years in our fellowship this past February. And I walked into John Mack's office, and John Mack told me that I should call my boss and tell him where I was, and I said, "John, it won't do any good." He looked at me and he said, "In that case, it won't do any harm, so you call him." I called him and he said he knew where I was because my wife had already called and told him. And he said he was trying to do something for me, but he didn't know what, if anything, could be done. But he would let me know in a day or two. And a couple of days later, he called me at the hospital and he said, "Chuck, I went all the way to the president of our company and we called the hospital. And we talked to your doctor and he explained to us what this thing called alcoholism is all about. And he convinced us that if you want to do something about your life, you have taken the first step by checking into that hospital. And for that reason, we've torn up your termination papers. And we've put you on medical leave and we don't care if it takes 60 days or 6 months, your job and your office will be waiting for you when you feel capable of coming back." The other thing that man did for me, he knew that I could not leave that hospital without a sponsor. And if you're new today and you don't know what a sponsor is, they're the ones that come in after the war is over and bayonet the wounded. Shame on me. John could have asked 100 men to come take me to my first meeting, but he only asked one man. And that man had no idea who he was coming to get, except my name was Chuck and I'd be ready at 7. And when I walked up to that nurse's station, he took one look at me and he said, "Welcome, Chuck. I've been saving a seat for you for over 8.5 years. Frank O. apostrophe R. was not only one of my oldest drinking friends, but he was also my family attorney, and I saw him almost on a daily basis. But never once did he ever try to force me into these rooms. He took me to my first meeting that night, my Wednesday night home group at Laguna, and I have no idea who spoke that night or what was said, but I know what happened after the meeting. Frank dropped Carolyn off at home, and he took me to an all-night coffee shop. And in that coffee shop, he practiced the ultimate principle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that ultimate principle is not me standing in a meeting talking to a lot of people. And it's not me or somebody like me standing at a convention like this talking to several thousands of people. The ultimate principle of Alcoholics Anonymous is one drunk talking to another drunk." And that night, Frank told me his whole story. That night, he convinced me that this program would work for me too, one day at a time, if I wanted it. Because this program is not for the people that need it, it's only for the people that want it. And if I chose to take this program when I got out of that hospital, I should try to get in it and not on it as soon as I could. And if you don't know the difference of being in something or on something, you just visualize yourself on a submarine when that sucker goes under. You would know the difference real quick. That night, through my friend Frank, God gave me the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. That gift turned into a miracle when a drunk like me accepted it. That night, Frank saved my life, and he didn't charge me one dime. Bob and Andy saved Frank's life almost 23 years ago, and they didn't charge him one dime. That's why I go anywhere within my physical or financial power to give back to you what you gave to me. And I have to do it for free and for fun, because that's the way I received it. I left that hospital that night, or that restaurant that night, with something I didn't have when I left the hospital. And that was a thing called hope. And I got back to that hospital and I finally got out. And I was told that I had to go to a meeting every single night for 6 solid months. And if I would act enthusiastic, I would become enthusiastic, and I tried it, and it worked. And I was sober 6 months, and I was worried about one thing in particular, and as I was driving to the Elks Club for lunch one day to have lunch with people in this fellowship, and at that time there was only about 5 or 6, and today there's 30 or 40, but I was worried about this thing you call God, because I had made the mistake at my first stag meeting of mentioning God. And some old-timer looked at me, and he said, "There's only 2 things you need to know about God. There is, and you ain't. Now shut up." And I never mentioned him again. But I thought about him. And I walked it, got to that parking lot, and I got out of my car, and as I did, my coat and my tie felt like they were choking me. And I turned around and I took them off and I laid them on the seat. And when I turned, I felt like I was lifted 6 feet off the ground. And as I started walking toward that building, which wasn't much further than that rail back there, it seemed like it took me 15 minutes to walk such a short way. I walked in that club and I sat down with Bob and Frank and Bill and Jack, and I have no idea what was said at lunch that day, and I have no idea if I even ate lunch or not. I went back to my office, and my secretary shared with me later that my normal routine in those days, I had 5 lines on my telephone, and all day long there would be calls going out all over the country and calls coming in. And she said for 4 solid hours I sat in my office, and I didn't make 1 call out, and I didn't get 1 call in. I went home that night, and as I walked in the door, my son was yelling something at his mother in the kitchen. And he turned and he screamed something at me. And as he did, I felt my feet come down and hit the carpet in the hall. And I turned and I went into my study and I closed the door and I sat in my chair and I cried as hard as I had ever cried in my life, because I knew that I had spent the day with God and everything was going to be okay in my life. I realized that night that I wasn't somebody bad trying to get good. I was somebody sick trying to get well. I found out that going to a lot of meetings was no excuse for not working the program. And I also found out that sobriety would do until surrender came along. And that night I totally surrendered my will and my life over to the care of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that I would have to do something that night that my sponsor said would be necessary, and I would know when to do it. I had the biggest resentment against my wife that any human being could ever carry for another. And I called her in the room and I looked at her and I said, from this night on, everything I have or ever will have belongs to you and our children. I am only here from this night on to add to your life and to add to their lives. And I have to do that without any expectations and without any conditions. And when I start putting expectations and conditions on our relationship, I am not practicing the program the way it's laid out for me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to tell you that from that night on, everything had been a bed of roses in my life, but that wouldn't be true. I have been a failure as a husband, as a father, as an employer, as an employee, and maybe even as a friend. But up until this morning, I have not failed Alcoholics Anonymous because I've not picked up that first drink. That job that fired me several years ago has tripled my responsibilities. And last month, I was back in Dearborn sitting at a lunch table with the chairman of our board, listening to him tell me what an important part I am in the organization today. And really what he was saying was thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous for giving you back to us. That man, that attorney that I was so rude to, was my greatest supporter to get me elected to a 5-year term on the board of trustees of the same club that my wife had to used to have to come get me out of because I was too drunk to drive. That friend that tried to save my job calls me every April to wish me well during my AA birthday week. That guy Jim that made the 12-step call on me, he saw fit to go back out for 5 more hospitals in several years. But he died just before Christmas of cancer, but he had 7 years in a row in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was 79 years old. And he called me sponsor, and I loved him like a dad. We have a daughter.
8 years ago, she brought my little granddaughter to her ex-husband, and she'll be 13 next month. And she told him that she couldn't separate herself from her alcohol and drugs long enough to be a mother to that child. And we have not heard one single word from her in all of these years, and we don't even know if she's alive today. Just before we left, we found out that that little girl, 12 years old, is in some kind of a psychiatric hospital because she has a problem. I know what her problem is. Her grandfather's an alcoholic. Her mother is an alcoholic. Her father is an alcoholic. And all she's ever asked for in life was to be held and hugged and loved and feel like somebody in this earth. And we say, when will it begin with me? And I hope that that's what I did when I came to this program. It began with me, with my family. Good, bad, or indifferent, I don't drink today. All I can do today is stand here and love that daughter and let God judge her. Because if she's alive today, I know that if I have a higher power, she has to have one. And she knows about this program, and she could be sitting in a room just like this today, putting her life back together. But I could not have done that if something had not happened in my life that, next to my own sobriety, meant more to me than anything in this world. And I'll share it in closing. That 18-year-old son that took me to that hospital became 22. And on his 22nd birthday, I took him to dinner. And he went his way and I went mine. And that following Saturday night, I was standing at a meeting in Tustin Hospital sharing, just like I am today. And there was a phone call, and they came and they interrupted me at the podium, and I went to the phone, and it was a deputy sheriff friend of mine at the Orange County Jail. And he told me that they had my son there, but if I would come down right away, he would release him to me until the hearing date, but to no one else. And I got down to that jail as fast as I could. And I got my son out, and I found out at that time he was so suicidal that I couldn't leave him for 15 minutes. And I couldn't go to work Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. And Wednesday night he heard me tell his mother that I had to get to an AA meeting, and he knew that normally she and I would be driving down the Laguna. And he came out of his room and he said, "Dad, you can't leave me in this house tonight by myself. Can I go just for the ride?" And his mother that night, in her wisdom, said, "Why don't you two go ahead and I'll just stay home tonight." And driving from Santa Ana down to Laguna that night, I shared things with that young man that I had never shared with anyone but his mother and my two sponsors. And I told him I was sorry about all the ball games and track meets I never got to. But I thought, because I took care of him and his sister so well in life, that one day he would become 21 and we could sit at the club and we could drink and become friends. And all of that would be forgiven. But because of my commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hoped and I prayed that that would never take place. We got to Laguna and they had their normal 200 plus people there. And when they asked for newcomers, my son stood up and he said, "My name is Chuck, and I'm an alcoholic and a full-blown drug addict." And as he sat down, he put his arms around me and he said, "Dad, I want what you've got." Now, he doesn't work the program the way I think he should, so I go to Al-Anon. Everything I have today belongs to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I wanted to drink again, I'd have to go back home. I'd have to pull in that driveway, go upstairs, take off these clothes and put on a pair of Levi's tennis shoes and a windbreaker. I'd have to leave my wallet, my car keys, my office keys, and my house keys, because they don't belong to me, they belong to you. Before I got here,
I would have sold everything I had for one bottle of vodka. But today, there isn't one newcomer in this room that doesn't mean more to me than everything I had before I got here, but I have to do it one day at a time. There are 2 days in every week about which we should not worry, 2 days which should be kept free from fear and apprehension. One of these days is yesterday, with its mistakes and cares, its faults and blunders, its aches and pains. Yesterday has passed forever beyond your control. All the money in the world cannot bring back yesterday. We cannot undo a single act we performed. We cannot erase a single word we said. Yesterday is gone. The other day we should not worry about is tomorrow, with its possible adversities, its burdens, its large promise and poor performance. Tomorrow is also beyond our immediate control. Tomorrow's sun will rise either in splendor or behind a mask of clouds, but it will rise. Until it does, we have no stake in tomorrow, for it is yet unborn. This leaves only one day today. Any man can fight the battles of just one day. It is only when you add the burdens of those two awful eternities, yesterday and tomorrow, that we break down. It is not the experience of today that drives men mad. It is remorse of bitterness for something which happened yesterday and the dread of what tomorrow may bring. Let us therefore live but one day at a time. Yesterday is already a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today well lived will make all of our yesterdays a dream of happiness, and all of our tomorrows a vision of hope. I love you very much. God bless you, and keep coming back. Thank you.